just on the task at hand, not SpaceX. It had shipped the Falcon 1 to Quaj in April with one set of engineers, and then put another group of engineers on a new project to develop the Falcon 9, a 9-engine rocket that would take the place of the Falcon 5 and serve as a possible replacement to the retiring space shuttle. SpaceX had yet to prove it could get to space successfully, but Musk kept positioning it to bid on big-ticket NASA contracts. By this time, Musk had built up a reputation as the hardest-charging man in the space business. Before settling on the Falcon 9, Musk planned to build something called the BFR, a.k.a. the Big Falcon Rocket, or Big Fucking Rocket. Musk wanted it to have the biggest rocket engine in history. Musk's bigger, faster mentality amused, horrified, and impressed some of the suppliers that SpaceX occasionally turned to for help, like Barber Nichols, Inc., a Colorado-based maker of rocket engine turbopumps and other aerospace machinery. A few executives at Barber Nichols, Robert Linden, Gary Frey, and Mike Forsha, were kind enough to recount their first meeting with Musk in the middle of 2002 and their subsequent dealings with him. Here's a snippet. Elon showed up with Tom Mueller and started telling us it was his destiny to launch things into space at lower costs and to help us become spacefaring people. We thought the world of Tom, but weren't quite sure whether to take Elon too seriously. They began asking us for the impossible. They wanted a turbopump to be built in less than a year for under $1 million. Boeing might do a project like that over 5 years for $100 million. Tom told us to give it our best shot, and we built it in 13 months. Build quick and learn quickly was Elon's philosophy. He was relentless in wanting the costs to come down. Regardless of what we showed him on paper with regard to the cost of materials, he wanted the cost lower, because that was part of his business model. It could be very frustrating to work with Elon. He has a singular view and doesn't deviate from that. We don't know too many people that have worked for him that are happy. That said, he has driven the cost of space down and been true to his original business plan. Boeing, Lockheed, and the rest of them have become overly cautious and spend a lot of money. SpaceX has balls. On July 30th, 2008, the Falcon 9 had a successful test fire in Texas, with all 9 of its engines lighting up and producing 850,000 pounds of thrust. 3 days later, in Quaj, SpaceX's engineers fueled up the Falcon 1 and crossed their fingers. The rocket had an Air Force satellite as its payload, along with a couple of experiments from NASA. All told, the cargo weighed 375 pounds. SpaceX had been making significant changes to its rocket since the last failed launch. A traditional aerospace company would not have wanted the added risk, but Musk insisted that SpaceX push its technology forward while at the same time trying to make it work right. Among the biggest changes for the Falcon 1 was a new version of the Merlin 1 engine that relied on a tweaked cooling system. The first launch attempt on August 2, 2008, aborted at T-minus 0 seconds. SpaceX regrouped and tried to launch again the same day. This time, everything seemed to be going well. The Falcon 1 soared into the sky and flew spectacularly without any indication of a problem. SpaceX employees watching a webcast of the proceedings back in California let out hoots and whistles. Then, right at the moment when the first stage and second stage were to separate, there was a malfunction. An analysis after the fact would show that the new engines had delivered an unexpected thrust during the separation process that caused the first stage to bump up into the second stage, damaging the top part of the rocket and its engine. To provide a glimpse of how well Musk knows the rockets, here he is explaining what happened from memory, 6 years after the fact. It was because we had upgraded the Merlin engine to a regeneratively cooled engine, and the thrust transient of that engine was a few seconds longer. It was only like 1% thrust for about another 1.5 seconds. And the chamber pressure was only 10 psi, which is 1% of the total. But that's below sea level pressure. On the test stand, we didn't notice anything. We thought it was fine. We thought it was just the same as before, but actually it just had this slight difference. The ambient sea level pressure was higher at roughly 15 psi, which disguised some effects during the test. The extra thrust caused the first stage to continue moving after stage separation and recontact the other stage. And the upper stage then started the engine inside the interstage, which caused the plasma blowback, which destroyed the upper stage. The failed launch left many SpaceX employees shattered. It was so profound seeing the energy shift over the room in the course of 30 seconds, said Dolly Singh, a recruiter at SpaceX. It was like the worst fucking day ever. You don't usually see grown-ups weeping, but there they were. We were tired and broken emotionally. Musk addressed the workers right away and encouraged them to get back to work. He said, "Look, we are going to do this. It's going to be okay. Don't freak out," Singh recalled. It was like magic. Everyone chilled out immediately and started to focus on figuring out what just happened and how to fix it. It went from despair to hope and focus. Musk put up a positive front to the public as well. In a statement, he said that SpaceX had another rocket waiting to attempt a fourth launch and a fifth launch planned shortly after that. "I have also given the go-ahead to begin a fabrication of Flight 6," he said. "Falcon 9 development will also continue unabated." In reality, the third launch was a disaster with cascading consequences. Since the second stage of the rocket did not fire properly, SpaceX never got a chance to see if it had really fixed the fuel sloshing issues that had plagued the second flight. Many of the SpaceX engineers were confident that they had solved this problem and were anxious to get to the fourth launch, believing that they had an easy answer for the recent thrust problem. For Musk, the situation seemed graver. "I was super depressed," Musk said. "If we hadn't solved the slush coupling problem on Flight 2, or there was just some random other thing that occurred, say a mistake in the launch process or the manufacturing process unrelated to anything previous, then game over." SpaceX simply did not have enough money to try a fifth flight. He'd put $100 million into the company and had nothing to spare because of the issues at Tesla. "Flight 4 was it," Musk said. If, however, SpaceX could nail the fourth flight, it would instill confidence on the part of the U.S. government and possible commercial customers, paving the way for the Falcon 9 and even more ambitious projects. Leading up to the third launch, Musk had been his usual ultra-involved self. Anyone at SpaceX who held the launch back went onto Musk's critical path shit list. Musk would hound the person responsible about the delays, but typically he would also do everything in his power to help solve problems. "I was personally holding up the launch once and had to give Elon twice daily updates about what was going on," said Kevin Brogan. But Elon would say, "There are 500 people at this company. What do you need?" One of the calls must have taken place while Musk courted Riley, because Brogan remembered Musk phoning from the bathroom of a London club to find out how welding had gone on a large part of the rocket. Musk fielded another call in the middle of the night while sleeping next to Riley, and had to whisper as he berated the engineers. "He's giving us the pillow talk voice, so we all have to huddle around the speakerphone while he tells us, 'You guys need to get your shit together,'" Brogan said. With the fourth launch, the demands and anticipation had ratcheted to the point that people started making silly mistakes. Typically, the body of the Falcon 1 rocket traveled to Quaj via barge. This time, Musk and the engineers were too excited and desperate to wait for the ocean journey. Musk rented a military cargo plane to fly the rocket body from Los Angeles to Hawaii and then on to Quaj. This would have been a fine idea, except the SpaceX engineers forgot to factor in what the pressurized plane would do to the body of the rocket, which is less than an eighth of an inch thick. As the plane started its descent into Hawaii, everyone inside of it could hear strange noises coming from the cargo hold. "I looked back and could see the stage crumpling," said Bulent Altan, the former head of avionics at SpaceX. "I told the pilot to go up, and he did." The rocket had behaved much like an empty water bottle will on a plane, with the air pressure pushing against the sides of the bottle and making it buckle. Altan calculated that the SpaceX team on the plane had about 30 minutes to do something about the problem before they would need to land. They pulled out their pocket knives and cut away the shrink wrap that held the rocket's body tight. Then they found a maintenance kit on the plane and used wrenches to open up some nuts on the rocket that would allow its internal pressure to match that of the plane's. When the plane landed, the engineers divvied up the duties of calling SpaceX's top executives to tell them about the catastrophe. It was 3 a.m. Los Angeles time, and one of the executives volunteered to deliver the horrific news to Musk. The thinking at the time was that it would take 3 months to repair the damage. The body of the rocket had caved in several places. Baffles placed inside the fuel tank to stop the sloshing problem had broken, and an assortment of other issues had appeared. Musk ordered the team to continue on to Quaj and sent in a reinforcement team with repair parts. 2 weeks later, the rocket had been fixed inside of the makeshift hangar. "It was like being stuck in a foxhole together," Altan said. "You weren't going to quit and leave the person next to you behind." When it was all done, everyone felt amazing. The fourth and possibly final launch for SpaceX took place on September 28, 2008. The SpaceX employees had worked non-stop shifts under agonizing pressure for 6 weeks to reach this day. Their pride as engineers and their hopes and dreams were on the line. "The people watching back at the factory were trying their best not to throw up," said James McClary, a machinist at SpaceX. Despite their past flubs, the engineers on Quaj were confident that this launch would work. Some of these people had spent years on the island, going through one of the more surreal engineering exercises in human history. They had been separated from their families, assaulted by the heat, and exiled on their tiny launch pad outpost, sometimes without much food, for days on end, as they waited for the launch windows to open and dealt with the aborts that followed. So much of that pain and suffering and fear would be forgotten if this launch went successfully. In the late afternoon on the 28th, the SpaceX team raised the Falcon 1 into its launch position. Once again it stood tall, looking like a bizarre artifact of an island tribe, as palm trees swayed beside it and a smattering of clouds crossed through the spectacular blue sky. By this time, SpaceX had upped its webcast game, turning each launch into a major production both for its employees and the public. Two SpaceX marketing executives spent 20 minutes before the launch going through all the technical ins and outs of the launch. The Falcon 1 was not carrying real cargo this time. Neither the company nor the military wanted to see something else blow up or get lost at sea. So the rocket held a 360-pound dummy payload. The fact that SpaceX had been reduced to launch theater did not faze the employees or dampen their enthusiasm. As the rocket rumbled and then climbed higher, the employees back at SpaceX headquarters let out raucous cheers. Each milestone that followed, clearing the island, engine checks coming back good, was again met with whistles and shouts. As the first stage fell away, the second stage fired up about 90 seconds into the flight, and the employees turned downright rapturous, filling the webcast with their ecstatic hollering. "Perfect," said one of the talking heads. The Kestrel engine glowed red and started its 6-minute burn. "When the second stage cleared, I could finally start breathing again, and my knees stopped buckling," said McClary. The fairing opened up around the 3-minute mark and fell back toward Earth. And finally, around 9 minutes into its journey, the Falcon 1 shut down just as planned and reached orbit, making it the first privately built machine to accomplish such a feat. It took 6 years, about 4.5 more than Musk had once planned, and 500 people to make this miracle of modern science and business happen. Earlier in the day, Musk had tried to distract himself from the mounting pressure by going to Disneyland with his brother Kimball and their children. Musk then had to race back to make the 4 p.m. launch, and walked into SpaceX's trailer control room about 2 minutes before blastoff. "When the launch was successful, everyone burst into tears," Kimball said. "It was one of the most emotional experiences I've had." Musk left the control room and walked out to the factory floor, where he received a rock star's welcome. "Well, that was freaking awesome," he said. "There are a lot of people who thought we couldn't do it. A lot, actually. But as the saying goes, the fourth time is the charm, right? There are only a handful of countries on Earth that have done this. It's normally a country thing, not a company thing. My mind is kind of frazzled, so it's hard for me to say anything, but man, this is definitely one of the greatest days in my life, and I think probably for most people here. We showed people we can do it. This is just the first step of many. I'm going to have a really great party tonight. I don't know about you guys." Mary Beth Brown then tapped Musk on the shoulder and pulled him away to a meeting. The afterglow of this mammoth victory faded soon after the party ended, and the severity of SpaceX's financial hell became top of mind again for Musk. SpaceX had the Falcon 9 efforts to support, and had also immediately green-lighted the construction of another machine, the Dragon capsule, that could be used to take supplies, and one day humans, to the International Space Station. Historically, either project would cost more than $1 billion to complete, but SpaceX would have to find a way to build both machines simultaneously for a fraction of the cost. The company had dramatically increased the rate at which it hired employees and moved into a much larger headquarters in Hawthorne, California. SpaceX had a commercial flight booked to carry a satellite into orbit for the Malaysian government, but that launch and the payment for it would not arrive until the middle of 2009. In the meantime, SpaceX simply struggled to make its payroll. The press did not know the extent of Musk's financial woes, but they knew enough to turn detailing Tesla's precarious financial situation into a favored pastime. A website called Truth About Cars began a Tesla Death Watch in May 2008 and followed up with dozens of entries throughout the year. The blog took special pleasure in rejecting the idea that Musk was a true founder of the company, presenting him as the money man and chairman who had more or less stolen Tesla from the genius engineer Eberhard. When Eberhard started a blog detailing the pros and cons of being a Tesla customer, the auto site was all too happy to echo his gripes. Top Gear, a popular British television show, ripped the Roadster apart, making it look as if the car had run out of juice during a road test. "People joke about the Tesla Death Watch and all that, but it was harsh," said Kimball Musk. "One day there were 50 articles about how Tesla will die." Then, in October 2008, just a couple weeks after SpaceX's successful launch, ValleyWag appeared on the scene again. First, it ridiculed Musk for officially taking over as CEO of Tesla and replacing Drury, on the grounds that Musk had just lucked into his past successes. It followed that by printing a tell-all email from a Tesla employee. The report said that Tesla had just gone through a round of layoffs, shut down its Detroit office, and had only $9 million left in the bank. "We have over 1,200 reservations, which means we've taken multiples of tens of millions of cash from our customers and have spent them all," the Tesla employee wrote. "Meanwhile, we only delivered less than 50 cars. I actually talked a close friend of mine into putting down $60,000 for a Tesla Roadster. I cannot conscientiously be a bystander anymore and allow my company to deceive the public and defraud our dear customers. Our customers and the general public are the reason Tesla is so loved. The fact that they're being lied to is just wrong." Musk would later discover the identity of this employee in an ingenious way. He copied the text of the letter into a Word document, checked the size of the file, sent it to a printer, and looked over the logs of printer activity to find one of the same size. He could then trace that back to the person who had printed the original file. The employee wrote a letter of apology and resigned. Yes, Tesla deserved much of the negative attention. Musk, though, felt like the 2008 climate with the hatred of bankers and the rich had turned him into a particularly juicy target. "I was just getting pistol-whipped," Musk said. There was a lot of schadenfreude at the time, and it was bad on so many levels. Justine was torturing me in the press. There were always all these negative articles about Tesla and the stories about SpaceX's third failure. It hurt really bad. You have these huge doubts that your life is not working, your car is not working, you're going through a divorce, and all of those things. I felt like a pile of shit. I didn't think we would overcome it. I thought things were probably fucking doomed. When Musk ran through the calculations concerning SpaceX and Tesla, it occurred to him that only one company would likely even have a chance at survival. "I could either pick SpaceX or Tesla, or split the money I had left between them," Musk said. That was a tough decision. If I split the money, maybe both of them would die. If I gave the money to just one company, the probability of it surviving was greater, but then it would mean certain death for the other company. I debated that over and over. While Musk meditated on this, the economy worsened quickly, and so too did Musk's financial condition. As 2008 came to an end, Musk had run out of money. Riley began to see Musk's life as a Shakespearean tragedy. Sometimes Musk would open up to her about the issues, and other times he retreated into himself. Riley spied on Musk while he read email and watched him grimace as the bad news poured in. "You'd witness him having these conversations in his head," she said. "It's really hard to watch someone you love struggle like that." Because of the long hours that he worked and his eating habits, Musk's weight fluctuated wildly. Bags formed under his eyes, and his countenance started to resemble that of a shattered runner at the back end of an ultramarathon. "He looked like death itself," Riley said. "I remember thinking this guy would have a heart attack and die. He seemed like a man on the brink." In the middle of the night, Musk would have nightmares and yell out. "He was in physical pain," Riley said. "He would climb on me and start screaming while still asleep." The couple had to start borrowing hundreds of thousands of dollars from Musk's friend Skull, and Riley's parents offered to remortgage their house. Musk no longer flew his jet back and forth between Los Angeles and Silicon Valley. He took Southwest. Burning through about $4 million a month, Tesla needed to close another major round of funding to get through 2008 and stay alive. Musk had to lean on friends just to try to make payroll from week to week as he negotiated with investors. He sent impassioned pleas to anyone he could think of who might be able to spare some money. Bill Lee invested $2 million in Tesla, and Sergey Brin invested $500,000. A bunch of Tesla employees wrote checks to keep the company going, said Dermot O'Connell, the vice president of business development at Tesla. They turned into investments, but at the time, it was $25,000 or $50,000 that you didn't expect to see again. It just seemed like, holy shit, this thing is going to crater. Kimball had lost most of his money during the recession when his investments bottomed out, but sold what he had left and put it into Tesla as well. "I was close to bankruptcy," Kimball said. Tesla had set the prepayments the customers made for the Roadsters aside, but Musk now needed to use that money to keep the company going, and soon those funds were gone too. These fiscal maneuvers worried Kimball. "I'm sure Elon would have found a way to make things right, but he definitely took risks that seemed like they could have landed him in jail for using someone else's money," he said. In December 2008, Musk mounted simultaneous campaigns to try to save his companies. He heard a rumor that NASA was on the verge of awarding a contract to resupply the space station. SpaceX's fourth launch had put it in a position to receive some of this money, which was said to be in excess of $1 billion. Musk reached out through some back channels in Washington and found out that SpaceX might even be a front-runner for the deal. Musk began doing everything in his power to assure people that the company could meet the challenge of getting a capsule to the ISS. As for Tesla, Musk had to go to his existing investors and ask them to pony up for another round of funding that needed to close by Christmas Eve to avoid bankruptcy. To give the investors some measure of confidence, Musk made a last-ditch effort to raise all the personal funds he could and put them into the company. He took out a loan from SpaceX, which NASA approved, and earmarked the money for Tesla. Musk went to the secondary markets to try to sell some of his shares in SolarCity. He also seized about $15 million that came through when Dell acquired a data center software startup called Everdream, founded by Musk's cousins, in which he had invested. "It was like the fucking Matrix," Musk said, describing his financial maneuvers. "The Everdream deal really saved my butt." Musk had cobbled together $20 million and asked Tesla's existing investors, since no new investors materialized, to match that figure. The investors agreed, and on December 3, 2008, they were in the process of finalizing the paperwork for the funding round when Musk noticed a problem. Vantage Point Capital Partners had signed all of the paperwork except for one crucial page. Musk phoned up Alan Saltzman, Vantage Point's co-founder and managing partner, to ask about the situation. Saltzman informed Musk that the firm had a problem with the investment round because it undervalued Tesla. "I said, I've got an excellent solution then. Take my entire portion of the deal. I had a real hard time coming up with the money. Based on the cash we have in the bank right now, we will bounce payroll next week. So unless you've got another idea, can you either just participate as much as you'd like or allow the round to go through? Because otherwise, we will be bankrupt." Saltzman balked and told Musk to come in the following week at 7 a.m. to present to Vantage Point's top brass. Not having a week of time to work with, Musk asked to come in the next day, and Saltzman refused that offer, forcing Musk to continue taking on loans. "The only reason he wanted the meeting at his office was for me to come on bended knee begging for money so he could say no," Musk theorized. "What a fuckhead." Vantage Point declined to speak about this period, but Musk believed that Saltzman's tactics were part of a mission to bankrupt Tesla. Musk feared that Vantage Point would oust him as CEO, recapitalize Tesla, and emerge as the major owner of the carmaker. It could then sell Tesla to a Detroit automaker or focus on selling electric drivetrains and battery packs instead of making cars. Such reasoning would have been quite practical from a business standpoint, but did not match up with Musk's goals for Tesla. Vantage Point was forcing that wisdom down the throat of an entrepreneur who wanted to do something bigger and bolder, said Steve Jurvetson, a partner at Draper Fisher Jurvetson and Tesla investor. Maybe they're used to a CEO buckling, but Elon doesn't do that. Instead, Musk took another huge risk. Tesla recharacterized the funding as a debt round rather than an equity round, knowing that Vantage Point could not interfere with a debt deal. The tricky part of this strategy was that investors like Jurvetson, who wanted to help Tesla, were put in a bind because venture capital firms are not structured to do debt deals. And convincing their backers to alter their normal rules of engagement for a company that could very well go bankrupt in a matter of days would be a very tough ask. Knowing this, Musk bluffed. He told the investors that he would take another loan from SpaceX and fund the entire round, all $40 million, himself. The tactic worked. When you have scarcity, it naturally reinforces greed and leads to more interest, Jurvetson said. It was also easier for us to go back to our firms and say, "Here is the deal, go or no go." The deal ended up closing on Christmas Eve, hours before Tesla would have gone bankrupt. Musk had just a few $100,000 left and could not have made payroll the next day. Musk ultimately put in $12 million, and the investment firms put up the rest. As for Saltzman, Musk said, "He should be ashamed of himself." At SpaceX, Musk and the company's top executives had spent most of December in a state of fear. According to reports in the press, SpaceX, the one-time front-runner for the large NASA contract, had suddenly lost favor with the space agency. Michael Griffin, who had once almost been a co-founder of SpaceX, was the head of NASA and had turned on Musk. Griffin did not care for Musk's aggressive business tactics, seeing him as borderline unethical. Others have suggested that Griffin ended up being jealous of Musk and SpaceX. Griffin had pined to build a massive new spacecraft that would solidify his mark on the industry. But with the election of Barack Obama in 2008, the Bush appointee knew that his time as NASA chief was coming to an end, and that SpaceX appeared poised to build the most interesting machines moving forward. On December 23, 2008, however, SpaceX received a shock. People inside NASA had backed SpaceX to become a supplier for the ISS. The company received $1.6 billion as payment for 12 flights to the space station. Staying with Kimball in Boulder, Colorado for the holidays, Musk broke down in tears as the SpaceX and Tesla transactions processed. "I hadn't had an opportunity to buy a Christmas present for Tallulah or anything," he said. "I went running down the fucking street in Boulder, and the only place that was open sold these shitty trinkets, and they were about to close. The best thing I could find were these plastic monkeys with coconuts, those see-no-evil, hear-no-evil monkeys." For Gracias, the Tesla and SpaceX investor and Musk's friend, the 2008 period told him everything he would ever need to know about Musk's character. He saw a man who arrived in the United States with nothing, who had lost a child, who was being pilloried in the press by reporters and his ex-wife, and who verged on having his life's work destroyed. "He has the ability to work harder and endure more stress than anyone I've ever met," Gracias said. "What he went through in 2008 would have broken anyone else. He didn't just survive. He kept working and stayed focused." That ability to stay focused in the midst of a crisis stands as one of Musk's main advantages over other executives and competitors. "Most people who are under that sort of pressure fray," Gracias said. "Their decisions go bad. Elon gets hyper-rational. He's still able to make very clear long-term decisions. The harder it gets, the better he gets." Anyone who saw what he went through firsthand came away with more respect for the guy. "I've just never seen anything like his ability to take pain." Chapter 9. Liftoff. The Falcon 9 has become SpaceX's workhorse. The rocket looks, let's face it, like a giant white phallus. It stands 224.4 feet tall, is 12 feet across, and weighs 1.1 million pounds. The rocket is powered by 9 engines arranged in an octaweb pattern at its base, with one engine in the center and 8 others encircling it. The engines connect to the first stage, or the main body of the rocket, which bears the blue SpaceX insignia and an American flag. The shorter second stage of the rocket sits on top of the first, and is the one that actually ends up doing things in space. It can be outfitted with a rounded container for carrying satellites or a capsule capable of transporting humans. By design, there's nothing particularly flashy about the Falcon 9's outward appearance. It's the spaceship equivalent of an Apple laptop or a Braun kettle, an elegant, purposeful machine stripped of frivolity and waste. SpaceX sometimes uses Vandenberg Air Force Base in Southern California to send up these Falcon 9 rockets. Were it not owned by the military, the base would be a resort. The Pacific Ocean runs for miles along its border, and its grounds have wide-open shrubby fields dotted by green hills. Nestled into one hilly spot just at the ocean's edge are a handful of launch pads. On launch days, the white Falcon 9 breaks up the blue and green landscape, pointing skyward and leaving no doubt about its intentions. About 4 hours before a launch, the Falcon 9 starts getting filled with an immense amount of liquid oxygen and rocket-grade kerosene. Some of the liquid oxygen vents out of the rocket as it awaits launch and is kept so cold that it boils off on contact with the metal and air, forming white plumes that stream down the rocket's sides. This gives the impression of the Falcon 9 huffing and puffing as it limbers up before the journey. The engineers inside of SpaceX's mission control monitor these fuel systems and all manner of other items. They chat back and forth through headsets and begin cycling through their launch checklist, consumed by what people in the business call go fever, as they move from one approval to the next. 10 minutes before launch, the humans step out of the way and leave the remaining processes up to automated machines. Everything goes quiet, and the tension builds until right before the main event. That's when, out of nowhere, the Falcon 9 breaks the silence by letting out a loud gasp. A white latticed support structure pulls away from its body. The T-minus 10 seconds countdown begins. Nothing much happens from 10 down to 4. At the count of 3, however, the engines ignite, and the computers conduct a last, oh-so-rapid health check. 4 enormous metal clamps hold the rocket down, as computing systems evaluate all 9 engines and measure if there's sufficient downward force being produced. By the time 0 arrives, the rocket has decided that all is well enough to go through with its mission, and the clamps release. The rocket goes to war with inertia, and then, with flames surrounding its base and snow-thick plumes of the liquid oxygen filling the air, it shoots up. Seeing something so large hold so straight and steady while suspended in midair is hard for the brain to register. It is foreign, inexplicable. About 20 seconds after liftoff, the spectators placed safely a few miles away catch the first faceful of the Falcon 9's rumble. It's a distinct sound, a sort of staccato crackling that arises from chemicals whipped into a violent frenzy. Pant legs vibrate from shockwaves produced by a stream of sonic booms coming out of the Falcon 9's exhaust. The white rocket climbs higher and higher with impressive stamina. After about a minute, it's just a red spot in the sky, and then, poof, it's gone. Only a cynical dullard could come away from witnessing this, feeling anything other than wonder at what man can accomplish. For Elon Musk, this spectacle has turned into a familiar experience. SpaceX has metamorphosed from the joke of the aeronautics industry into one of its most consistent operators. SpaceX sends a rocket up about once a month, carrying satellites for companies and nations, and supplies to the International Space Station, where the Falcon 1 blasting off from Kwajalein was the work of a startup. The Falcon 9 taking off from Vandenberg is the work of an aerospace superpower. SpaceX can undercut its U.S. competitors, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Orbital Sciences, on price by a ridiculous margin. It also offers U.S. customers a peace of mind that its rivals can't. Where these competitors rely on Russian and other foreign suppliers, SpaceX makes all of its machines from scratch in the United States. Because of its low costs, SpaceX has once again made the United States a player in the worldwide commercial launch market. Its $60 million per launch cost is much less than what Europe and Japan charge, and trumps even the relative bargains offered by the Russians and Chinese, who have the added benefit of decades of sunk government investment into their space programs, as well as cheap labor. The United States continues to take great pride in having Boeing compete against Airbus and other foreign aircraft makers. For some reason, though, government leaders and the public have been willing to concede much of the commercial launch market. It's a disheartening and short-sighted position. The total market for satellites, related services, and the rocket launches needed to carry them to space has exploded over the past decade, from about $60 billion per year to more than $200 billion. A number of countries pay to send up their own spy, communication, and weather satellites. Companies then turn to space for television, internet, radio, weather, navigation, and imaging services. The machines in space supply the fabric of modern life, and they're going to become more capable and interesting at a rapid pace. A whole new breed of satellite makers has just appeared on the scene, with the ability to answer Google-like queries about our planet. These satellites can zoom in on Iowa and determine when cornfields are at peak yields and ready to harvest. And they can count cars in Walmart parking lots throughout California to calculate shopping demand during the holiday season. The startups making these types of innovative machines must often turn to the Russians to get them into space. But SpaceX intends to change that. The United States has remained competitive in the most lucrative parts of the space industry, building the actual satellites and complementary systems and services to run them. Each year, the United States makes about one-third of all satellites and takes about 60% of the global satellite revenue. The majority of this revenue comes from business done with the U.S. government. China, Europe, and Russia account for almost all of the remaining satellite sales and launches. It's expected that China's role in the space industry will increase, while Russia has vowed to spend $50 billion on revitalizing its space program. This leaves the United States dealing with two of its least favored nations in space matters, and doing so without much leverage. Case in point, the retirement of the space shuttle made the United States totally dependent on the Russians to get astronauts to the ISS. Russia gets to charge $70 million per person for the trip, and to cut the United States off as it sees fit during political rifts. At present, SpaceX looks like the best hope of breaking this cycle and giving back to America its ability to take people into space. SpaceX has become the free radical trying to upend everything about this industry. It doesn't want to handle a few launches per year or to rely on government contracts for survival. Musk's goal is to use manufacturing breakthroughs and launch pad advances to create a drastic drop in the cost of getting things to space. Most significant, he's been testing rockets that can push their payload to space and then return to Earth and land with supreme accuracy on a pad floating at sea, or even their original launch pad. Instead of having its rockets break apart after crashing into the sea, SpaceX will use reverse thrusters to lower them down softly and reuse them. Within the next few years, SpaceX expects to cut its price to at least one-tenth that of its rivals. Reusing its rockets will drive the bulk of this reduction and SpaceX's competitive advantage. Imagine one airline that flies the same plane over and over again, competing against others that dispose of their planes after every flight. It should be noted that there are many people in the space industry who doubt reusable rockets will work, in large part because of the stress the machines and metal go through during launch. It's not clear that the most prized customers will even consider the reused spacecraft for launches due to their inherent risks. This is a big reason that other countries and companies have not pursued the technology. There's a camp of space experts who think Musk is flat out wasting his time, and that engineering calculations already prove the reusable rockets to be a fool's errand. Through its cost advantages, SpaceX hopes to take over the majority of the world's commercial launches, and there's evidence that the company is on its way toward doing just that. To date, it has flown satellites for Canadian, European, and Asian customers, and completed about 24 launches. Its public launch manifest stretches out for a number of years, and SpaceX has more than 50 flights planned, which are altogether worth more than $5 billion. The company remains privately owned, with Musk as the largest shareholder, alongside outside investors, including venture capital firms like the Founders Fund and Draper Fisher Jurvetson, giving it a competitive ethos its rivals lack. Since getting past its near-death experience in 2008, SpaceX has been profitable and is estimated to be worth $12 billion. Zip2, PayPal, Tesla, Solar City. They are all expressions of Musk. SpaceX is Musk. Its foibles emanate directly from him, as do its successes. Part of this comes from Musk's maniacal attention to detail and involvement in every SpaceX endeavor. He's hands-on to a degree that would make Hugh Hefner feel inadequate. Part of it stems from SpaceX being the apotheosis of the cult of Musk. Employees fear Musk. They adore Musk. They give up their lives for Musk, and they usually do all of this simultaneously. Musk's demanding management style can only flourish because of the otherworldly, in a literal sense, aspirations of the company. While the rest of the aerospace industry has been content to keep sending what look like relics from the 1960s into space, SpaceX has made a point of doing just the opposite. Its reusable rockets and reusable spaceships look like true 21st century machines. The modernization of the equipment is not just for show. It reflects SpaceX's constant push to advance its technology and change the economics of the industry. Musk does not simply want to lower the cost of deploying satellites and resupplying the space station. He wants to lower the cost of launches to the point that it becomes economical and practical to fly thousands upon thousands of supply trips to Mars and start a colony. Musk wants to conquer the solar system, and as it stands, there's just one company where you can work if that sort of quest gets you out of bed in the morning. It seems unfathomable, but the rest of the space industry has made space boring. The Russians, who dominate much of the business of sending things and people to space, do so with decades-old equipment. The cramped Soyuz capsule that takes people to the space station has mechanical knobs and computer screens that appear unchanged from its inaugural 1966 flight. Countries new to the space race have mimicked the antiquated Russian and American equipment with maddening accuracy. When young people get into the aerospace industry, they're forced to either laugh or cry at the state of the machines. Nothing sucks the fun out of working on a spaceship like controlling it with mechanisms last seen in a 1960s laundromat. And the actual work environment is as outmoded as the machines. Hotshot college graduates have historically been forced to pick between a variety of slow-moving military contractors and interesting but ineffectual startups. Musk has managed to take these negatives surrounding the aerospace business and turn them into gains for SpaceX. He's presented the company as anything but another aerospace contractor. SpaceX is the hip, forward-thinking place that's brought the perks of Silicon Valley, namely frozen yogurt, stock options, speedy decision-making, and a flat corporate structure, to a staid industry. People who know Musk well tend to describe him more as a general than a CEO, and this is apt. He's built an engineering army by having the pick of just about anyone in the business that SpaceX wants. The SpaceX hiring model places some emphasis on getting top marks at top schools. But most of the attention goes toward spotting engineers who have exhibited type A personality traits over the course of their lives. The company's recruiters look for people who might excel at robot building competitions, or who are car racing hobbyists who have built unusual vehicles. The object is to find individuals who ooze passion, can work well as part of a team, and have real-world experience bending metal. Even if you're someone who writes code for your job, you need to understand how mechanical things work, said Dolly Singh, who spent 5 years as the head of talent acquisitions at SpaceX. We were looking for people that had been building things since they were little. Sometimes these people walked through the front door. Other times, Singh relied on a handful of enterprising techniques to find them. She became famous for trawling through academic papers to find engineers with very specific skills, cold calling researchers at labs and plucking possessed engineers out of college. At trade shows and conferences, SpaceX recruiters wooed interesting candidates they had spotted with a cloak and dagger shtick. They would hand out blank envelopes that contained invitations to meet at a specific time and place, usually a bar or restaurant near the event, for an initial interview. The candidates that showed up would discover they were among only a handful of people who had been anointed out of all the conference attendees. They were immediately made to feel special and inspired. Like many tech companies, SpaceX subjects potential hires to a gauntlet of interviews and tests. Some of the interviews are easygoing chats in which both parties get to feel each other out. Others are filled with quizzes that can be quite hard. Engineers tend to face the most rigorous interrogations, although business types and salesmen are made to suffer too. Coders who expect to pass through standard challenges have rude awakenings. Companies will typically challenge software developers on the spot by asking them to solve problems that require a couple of dozen lines of code. The standard SpaceX problem requires 500 or more lines of code. All potential employees who make their way to the end of the interview process then handle one more task. They're asked to write an essay for Musk about why they want to work at SpaceX. The reward for solving the puzzles, acting clever in interviews, and penning up a good essay is a meeting with Musk. He interviewed almost every one of SpaceX's first 1,000 hires, including the janitors and technicians, and has continued to interview the engineers as the company's workforce swelled. Each employee receives a warning before going to meet with Musk. The interview, he or she is told, could last anywhere from 30 seconds to 15 minutes. Elon will likely keep on writing emails and working during the initial part of the interview and not speak much. Don't panic. That's normal. Eventually, he will turn around in his chair to face you. Even then, though, he might not make actual eye contact with you or fully acknowledge your presence. Don't panic. That's normal. In due course, he will speak to you. From that point, the tales of engineers who have interviewed with Musk run the gamut from torturous experiences to the sublime. He might ask one question, or he might ask several. You can be sure, though, that he will roll out the riddle. You're standing on the surface of the earth. You walk 1 mile south, 1 mile west, and 1 mile north. You end up exactly where you started. Where are you? One answer to that is the North Pole, and most of the engineers get it right away. That's when Musk will follow with, where else could you be? The other answer is somewhere close to the South Pole, where if you walk 1 mile south, the circumference of the Earth becomes 1 mile. Fewer engineers get this answer, and Musk will happily walk them through that riddle and others and cite any relevant equations during his explanations. He tends to care less about whether or not the person gets the answer than about how they describe the problem and their approach to solving it. When speaking to potential recruits, Singh tried to energize them and be upfront about the demands of SpaceX and of Musk at the same time. The recruiting pitch was SpaceX is special forces, she said. If you want as hard as it gets, then great. If not, then you shouldn't come here. Once at SpaceX, the new employees found out very quickly if they were indeed up for the challenge. Many of them would quit within the first few months because of the 90-plus hour work weeks. Others quit because they could not handle just how direct Musk and the other executives were during meetings. Elon doesn't know about you, and he hasn't thought through whether or not something is going to hurt your feelings, Singh said. He just knows what the fuck he wants done. People who did not normalize to his communication style did not do well. There's an impression that SpaceX suffers from incredibly high turnover, and the company has, without question, churned through a fair number of bodies. Many of the key executives who helped start the company, however, have hung on for a decade or more. Among the rank-and-file engineers, most people stay on for at least 5 years to have their stock options vest and to see their projects through. This is typical behavior for any technology company. SpaceX and Musk also seem to inspire an unusual level of loyalty. Musk has managed to conjure up that Steve Jobs-like zeal among his troops. His vision is so clear, Singh said. He almost hypnotizes you. He gives you the crazy eye and it's like, yes, we can get to Mars. Take that a bit further, and you arrive at a pleasure-pain, sadomasochistic vibe that comes with working for Musk. Numerous people interviewed for this book decried the work hours, Musk's blunt style, and his sometimes ludicrous expectations. Yet almost every person, even those who had been fired, still worshipped Musk and talked about him in terms usually reserved for superheroes or deities. SpaceX's original headquarters in El Segundo were not quite up to the company's desired image as a place where the cool kids want to work. This is not a problem for SpaceX's new facility in Hawthorne. The building's address is One Rocket Road, and it has the Hawthorne Municipal Airport and several tooling and manufacturing companies as neighbors. While the SpaceX building resembles the others in size and shape, its all-white color makes it the obvious outlier. The structure looks like a gargantuan, rectangular glacier that's been planted in the midst of a particularly soulless portion of Los Angeles County's sprawl. Visitors to SpaceX have to walk past a security guard and through a small executive parking lot where Musk parks his black Model S, which flanks the building's entryway. The front doors are reflective and hide what's on the inside, which is more white. There are white walls in the foyer, a funky white table in the waiting area, and a white check-in desk with a pair of orchids sitting in white pots. After going through the registration process, guests are given a name badge and led into the main SpaceX office space. Musk's cubicle, a supersize unit, sits to the right, where he has a couple of celebratory Aviation Week magazine covers up on the wall, pictures of his boys next to a huge flat-screen monitor, and various knickknacks on his desk, including a boomerang, some books, a bottle of wine, and a giant samurai sword named Lady Vivamus, which Musk received when he won the Heinlein Prize, an award given for big achievements in commercial space. Hundreds of other people work in cubicles amid the big, wide-open area, most of them executives, engineers, software developers, and salespeople tapping away on their computers. The conference rooms that surround their desks all have space-themed names like Apollo or Wernher von Braun, and little nameplates that explain the label's significance. The largest conference rooms have ultra-modern chairs, high-backed, sleek red jobs that surround large glass tables, while panoramic photos of a Falcon 1 taking off from Quadge or the Dragon capsule docking with the ISS hang on the walls in the background. Take away the rocket swag and the samurai sword, and this central part of the SpaceX office looks just like what you might find at your run-of-the-mill Silicon Valley headquarters. The same thing cannot be said for what visitors encounter as they pass through a pair of double doors into the heart of the SpaceX factory. The 550,000-square-foot factory floor is difficult to process at first glance. It's one continuous space with grayish epoxied floors, white walls, and white support columns. A small city's worth of stuff, people, machines, noise, has been piled into this area. Just near the entryway, one of the Dragon capsules that has gone to the ISS and returned to Earth hangs from the ceiling with black burn marks running down its side. Just under the capsule on the ground are a pair of the 25-foot-long landing legs built by SpaceX to let the Falcon rocket come to a gentle rest on the ground after a flight so it can be flown again. To the left side of this entryway area, there's a kitchen, and to the right side, there's the mission control room. It's a closed-off area with expansive glass windows and fronted by wall-sized screens for tracking a rocket's progress. It has four rows of desks with about 10 computers each for the mission control staff. Step a bit farther into the factory, and there are a handful of industrial work areas separated from each other in the most informal of ways. In some spots, there are blue lines on the floor to mark off an area. And in other spots, blue workbenches have been arranged in squares to cordon off the space. It's a common sight to have one of the Merlin engines raised up in the middle of one of these work areas, with a half dozen technicians wiring it up and tuning its bits and pieces. Just behind these workspaces is a glass-enclosed square big enough to fit two of the Dragon capsules. This is a clean room, where people must wear lab coats and hairnets to fiddle with the capsules without contaminating them. About 40 feet to the left, there are several Falcon 9 rockets lying next to each other horizontally that have been painted and await transport. There are some areas tucked in between all of this that have blue walls and appear to have been covered by fabric. These are top-secret zones, where SpaceX might be working on a fanciful astronaut's outfit, or rocket part that it has to hide from visitors and employees not tied to the projects. There's a large area off to the side where SpaceX builds all of its electronics, another area for creating specialized composite